We're looking together at the Bible's big story, where every page whispers the name of Jesus. And each time we're looking at these individual passages, we're being asking the question, well, how does this lock into the big story? How does it lock into the Bible's big story of revelation, of God saying, this is who I am, of the big story of rescue, this is what God has come to do? Last Sunday morning, we were together in the prophets, a big section that runs from Isaiah all the way through to Malachi. And we were looking in particular at Isaiah and looking at five or six chapters that were kind of mountaintop experiences where you got in each one of them a glimpse of the rescuer to come. What's this rescuer going to be like? What is this promised king? Well, he's going to be a king, but he's going to be poor. He's going to reign, but he's going to be a servant. But what will make this king different is that it is not that his people fight for him, but he will fight for his people. And he will rescue them. An astonishing thing is this, that as we go through the prophets, that is, even as we start from Genesis all the way through, that all we have is the promise of God that goes away back to Genesis 3 and Genesis 12. And death won't stop the promise of God. Sin won't hinder the promise of God. Time won't exhaust the promise of God. And we have this amazing hope that even though the people are about to be sent into exile, that God is still speaking. And this morning we are in the book of Daniel. And the first six chapters of Daniel are really familiar. And you might think, well, why is Daniel in amongst the prophets? It's because the more unfamiliar chapters from 7 to 12 are why he is placed there. And we're here with Daniel, still a prophet. And the people are no longer in Jerusalem, but the judgment of God has come. The kingdoms have been divided. The kingdoms have been overthrown. And they are now in a time of exile. As a young boy, Daniel was taken to be a stranger in a strange land. That here he was, taken from home, taken from his family, raised by a country that didn't know God or love God, and yet there Daniel is. And the story so far, and if you're familiar with the opening five chapters, the story so far is that it has been something of an encouraging picture, not least from where it began. It begins with exile, but here you have Daniel, six chapters later, having one of the three most important jobs in the kingdom. And the message is clear that as you look at the book of Daniel, God is in control and not kings or presidents or prime ministers. God is in control, not kings, and it doesn't matter where God's people are, he still reigns. And the book of Daniel describes for us a chaotic world, and not least a chaotic world, but what you discover, let me put it like this, in all the years I've been here in Christ, and I've lost count of how many primary school head teachers have come and gone. And the same with secondary school head teachers that have come and gone. And I'm not comparing myself to Daniel at all, but in this chaotic world, the one constant that we find is Daniel. And he survives kings as they come and go, as empires change. The one constant through the turmoil of the empire is the quiet, persistent witness of God's people. And what we discover about Daniel and his friends, and what we discover about the people of Israel, is that here they are in a strange land. Here they are being ruled by a pagan king. And what do they do? There are three standouts. The first is that they seek the good of the city. They seek the best for the empire. The second thing that they do is that, as a stranger in a strange land, they seek to be faithful to God. And the third thing, that all the way through, God's glory always comes first. So there they are, stranger in a strange land. And think of it like this. It is no, the Christians used to be the good guys, but we're now the bad guys. We used to be in the public square, but we're not in the public square anymore. And we kind of bump our gums about it quite a bit. But Daniel's got a lot to teach us about seeking the good of the city, about seeking to be faithful and seeking God's glory as a stranger in a strange land. But here's what's great about Daniel 6. What age is Daniel in chapter 6? He's 80. And so that picture that you have as a young, vibrant, muscular, athletic Christian, it's not that he might still be muscular and athletic. There's a guy down in England at 79 who's still playing rugby. He is my inspiration. I want to beat him. But he's 80 years old. And here's the point. God's not finished with Daniel yet, even though he's in his 80s. God hasn't finished using him yet. And in some ways, the hardest part of Daniel's discipleship was not as a youth, but as an older, established man of faith. And what we discover here in Daniel chapter 6 is that for Daniel, the best is yet to come. It was his friends who faced the fiery furnace, not him. But now, when he is older and thinking he can retire and withdraw from service and not walk with Jesus as close as he used to, and that things will be easier now, because what the devil does is that he looks at your age and goes, "You've retired, I'll leave you alone." Or God says, "Oh, they've got an age, well, we'll just let them be, there's nothing more for them to do." Do you remember Caleb? What age was Caleb? He was 80, and he came to Joshua and said, "What's the hardest job? Give it to me. Give it to me." I hate to disappoint some of you. When it comes to kingdom work, there is no retirement. When it comes to an enemy who hates God, he doesn't retire you out of the front line either. And so there is both that encouragement and that warning when you see Daniel, when he reached a particular age, that things have actually become harder. And what happens here, particularly in the opening 9 verses, is that something stands out in the entire kingdom. Now, it's true that Daniel was a man of obvious gifts and talents, being blessed by God. But what stands out about Daniel in this chapter are not his gifts, and not his talents, not his successes, but what stands out about Daniel is his character. Look at how it's described. An excellent spirit was in him. Not how he looked, not how he stood, but his character. And it's remarkable that what happens here is that it's his character that arouses jealousy. Why would character arouse jealousy? Well, here we discover it's because of his integrity. In all the surveys that have been done about leadership, and all the surveys that have been done about in business, about what you expect from a CEO, do you know the first thing that comes out from employees? Integrity. Integrity. But the problem for others is that because of the integrity of Daniel, they don't get to be on the gravy train anymore. And what we discover about those that can't stand Daniel is they've got no care for the king, and they've got no care for the people, because they want to seek positions of power so that they might benefit from it. I don't know if anyone follows some of the politics in America. It's absolute. It's a different world. It's on a different scale. But one of the remarkable things is that if you become a senator, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, do you know what happens to you very quickly if you are not already? You become a multimillionaire. And you wonder why people seek positions of office. You wonder why people seek to control how things are voted on, when they discover that there's a gravy train to be enjoyed. And so what we discover here is that it is no different now as it was then. But think for a moment about what Jesus endured. Mark chapter 3, verse 16 says this. The Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him. Listen to what it says in Matthew chapter 26 in verse 59. It says, now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking false witnesses against Jesus that they might put him to death. But they found none, though many false witnesses came forward. And what Jesus warns us in John chapter 15 is this. He says, if the world hates you, know that it has hated me before it hated you. And right here in Daniel chapter 6 is that even though he is in his 80s, here is the cost that faithfulness brings. Here is the challenge of integrity. And yet there is a particular beauty that the only charge that they could bring against him was not in his character, was not in the quality of his work. The only charge they could bring against him was that he was a man who loved God first. The only charge. They could rifle through his tax returns. They could look at how he dealt with superiors or inferiors. They could look at how he engaged. They could look at his personal finances. They could look at all of it. They found nothing to bring a charge against him. The only charge? He loved God first. And so here Daniel is now under this kind of pressure cooker. And what we discover about Daniel is the response that he has when under pressure. And what Daniel does when he is under pressure, what Daniel does when he is being treated unfairly, is that he does not start a new habit, but continues with the old. He doesn't respond with a new action, but continues with that which had been his daily routine. What does Daniel do when he's under pressure? He doesn't start going to a prayer meeting. He went to the one that he always went to. He doesn't look at a big crisis and think there's something that we must do. He says, we do what we always have done. Look at what he does. He prayed. And he prays in the same manner. Look at what it says in verse 10. When Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber and opened toward Jerusalem. He got down on his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he had done previously. Here's the boy who had become a man. In the beginning of Daniel, you discover that he makes choices about integrity before God. Well, we discover that that which he did in his youth, he now does in his old age. Here is what it is to live a consistent life. Here is what it is to carry the zeal of youth into old age. He's got an active life. He's still running flat out. But he's not living on past success, but present devotion. He's faithful to God and trusting God with the consequences. And you get another glimpse of Jesus here, and you get another glimpse of Jesus in the garden. Because the question is not how can I be like Daniel? You shouldn't go away this morning and go, I'm pure taking it to the lions this morning. Come on then. But we are meant to look at Daniel so that we might discover what it means to be like Jesus. What can I see in Daniel's life that points me to Christ? What did Jesus do in the moment of crisis in the garden? He prayed. But what had he done his entire life? He prayed. But his friends, or rather his enemies and his colleagues, find a weakness. Where is the weakness to get to Daniel? Where is the weakness to undermine him? It's not found in Daniel, but the weakness is found in a king, in his pride, in his vanity. And what we discover is that it is others who pay the price of people pleasers and our vanity. And here's another Easter egg. Who does he sound like? Sounds a bit like Pilate. Or maybe better, he sounds more like Herod. Do not think that because you are a Christian and are faithful to God, that that means that life will be fair for you. God never promised a fair life. Being a Christian does not equate that everyone will treat you fairly. But what hope is there for Daniel? Well, let me show you where the hope is for Daniel. You find it in Psalm 3. Don't worry about looking it up just now. Let me read it to you. And before we read it, think of your circumstance and situation. Think of what is happening in the world. And let the Bible's songbook speak to you. Because this is what Daniel would have had to rest in. Listen to what it says in Psalm 3. O Lord, how many are my foes? Many are rising against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no salvation for him in God. But you, O Lord, are a shield around me, my glory and the lifter of my head. I cried aloud to the Lord, and he answered me from his holy hill. I lay down and slept. I woke again, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of many thousands of people who have set themselves all against me. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God. For you strike all my enemies on the cheek, you break the teeth of the wicked. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing will be on your people. And the one who just fills Daniel's horizons, that shapes his character, that shapes his daily life, that shapes his routine, is who God is. Not the circumstance, but whom God is. And three great reversals happen in the chat passage. And the three reversals are these. The first of all, Daniel is locked in, but then is released unharmed. What an extraordinary reversal. The accusers stand outside confident and free, but end up locked inside and dying. The emotions of the king are the great reversal, where he begins the passage by saying, worship me. There's nobody like me. Whas like us and they're all dead. No wonder we sing, I did it my way at funerals. Who's like me? How does the passage end? Tremble before God. Tremble before God. And he has his own reversal where he goes from tones of anguish to leaving rejoicing. And it's true that there are difficult thoughts in this passage. Difficult thoughts about the judgment that falls upon the enemies of Daniel and his families. For the way that we discover that there is no hope outside of God. There are difficult thoughts about the consequences that other people live with because of choices that we make. But there's also a verse that could be misapplied. Look at what it says, verse 23, and think for a moment how you could misapply this. It says this, then the king was exceedingly glad and commanded that Daniel be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den and no kind of harm was found in him because he had trusted in his God. How could that be misapplied? If I just do the right thing, nothing bad will ever happen to me. Or if something bad has happened to me, it's because I am a bad person. You have to understand this verse in its context. What would you say to Stephen on the day when you meet him in heaven? Aye, Stephen, if you'd been a better person, no one would have thrown any stones at you. If you had just trusted God better, then you wouldn't have died. Do you see how easy it is to misapply? When you take a verse out of context, you're left with a pretext, and you can make an unbearable burden for somebody in their life. It's saying in this context, in this situation, but there's also Stephen's. There are also those who give great glory to God, not because they are set free from the line. What would you say to those first-generation Christians who died in the Colosseum because of wild animals? You didn't trust enough? It's not what it says. It's not what it says. But what we discover is that there are these great encouragements to keep going. But as we're running out of time, what I want us to do is to jump ahead, because